My name is Ann Basie, can you hear? Okay, all right, I was just warming up. My name is Ann Basie and I'm the person leading this session. Thank you all for coming. This is the first in a series of 5 sessions this week that will ask different questions about simple living. So I just want to kind of give you the idea. I mean, in case you're here for all 5 days, here's what's going to happen. I changed it a little bit from last week, so it's kind of starting and concluding differently. We have today's session called Leaving the Path, and I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes, what we're going to be doing. Tomorrow I get to go hiking. Wednesday, the session is, the title got left off the schedule. The title is Powers and Principalities. And that's kind of an inquiry together about some of the cultural values that drive the systems that make it difficult for us to choose a more simple life. So it's kind of a deeper cause examination about some of the things about our culture that keep us all from living a little more simply and respectfully. Thursday, there is a session called Climate Engineering 101. I read this expert who said, from here on out, we are all climate engineers. No matter what you know or don't know, we are all climate engineers now. And so that is, I'm not an engineer, but apparently I'm a climate engineer, like all of us. So that is a really basic kind of climate change for dummies presentation, and then kind of looking more at the green end of sustainable simple living. Friday night we have a session that's new for this week called Clearing Up the Calendar. I know in my life trying to live more simply, it's always easier to deal with stuff. The calendar is very tough. Friday night we'll talk about time. And then Saturday morning is Church Basements as Cells of Resistance, which is when I hope to empower all of you as co-conspirators in the movement to helping all of us examine some different alternative ways to live and to go home and let our congregations know as well and encourage them. So that's the overall view for this week. Today's session, what's it called? Leading the Path. We'll feature some guest wisdom from the village. There's some other speakers besides me. But let me start with telling you who I am, why I do this, and we'll get going now. My name is Ann Basie, and I get to talk about this topic because I wrote a little book that was published by the ELCA World Hunger Appeal a couple of years ago called Sustaining Simplicity. I'm showing it to you because it's in the bookstore, and the bookstore likes to sell the books that the teaching staff order. There's also brochures. If you're not quite committed, take a brochure instead, and you can buy it online. This book was commissioned by my... Until a couple of weeks ago, I worked for the Global Mission Unit in the ELCA Churchwide, and I come here every summer, and I'm always a housekeeper. So it was because my colleagues in World Hunger knew something about how I live that they said, would you please write a book about simple living? And it was to help fulfill the fourth objective of the ELCA World Hunger Appeals goals, which says to encourage members of this church to practice responsible stewardship of their lives and their financial resources towards the prevention and alleviation of hunger. So it was part of a shift on the part of some of the World Hunger Education staff to look at who we are and what our lives are all about, as well as and the impact of our lives elsewhere in the world through the programs that we fund. When they asked me to write this book, they said, here's what we don't want you to do. Please don't write a book telling why you should live a simple life. Okay? And please don't write a book that's full of tips on how to be simple. Just write a book in the form of a journal, please, that talks about how someone who lives this way gets through the day, makes choices, thinks, decides. So that was what I did for them. So this is the story of a year, the year 2005 now, which is fading quickly. In my life and my son's life. And the goal of it was to try to lift up in kind of a gentle way an inquiry around simple living instead of hitting all of us over the head with it, just to invite people into the conversation with the goal on the part of World Hunger of trying to amplify conversations around simple living in the ELCA. And I think that cultures on our side, a lot of things are moving that way because of the economy, because of awareness of global warming, it's an easier conversation to have. So that's my background. So let me tell you about, I feel like I'm going to tell you who I used to be. since I've sort of made a big change. But the way that I was living in Chicago when I was writing this book, just to kind of give you my big city version, there are many different ways, and I know there's a lot of expertise in this room. Probably a lot of you are doing things on your own. And there's, depending on where you live, you know, that has a lot to do with what your choices can be. So mine was kind of a big city, urban, simple life. I sold my car in 2001, which was a gradual process. I would say any big stuff like that, you don't just like sell it and overnight you know what to do. It was like breaking a habit, but now I'm free of the habit. So I found a lot of ways to get around Chicago with public transportation. Car sharing began, which you're all familiar with in Seattle. Chicago was another city where that got going about 8 years ago now. Bicycle, walking. I lived in a dense neighborhood. It was easy to get around. I didn't sell my car until my son started high school. Before that, of course, my life was taking him to soccer practices, etc. And once he said, no problem, Mom, I'll get there on my own. And once he moved to a high school that was right on public transportation, it was much easier to think about making that decision. I wouldn't have done it, I think, if I had smaller children to cart around. I did a lot of recycling, did a lot of saving energy, was part of a program that, through the electric company, that you get a separate meter that charges you exactly the price of the electricity at the moment that it's used. And the idea behind that then is instead of paying the blended rate, the consumer, you can just shift your usage. So I could run my dishwasher at 11 o'clock at night and always pay about 2 cents a kilowatt, as opposed to running it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a day when it's 90 degrees and everybody's air conditioner is running, when the kilowatt hour of energy is going to be much more expensive. So that idea on the part of the utility was to, you know, link consumer behavior with some financial incentives. So it was interesting to be part of that. Clothes have not really been too important for me. Potty Patrol has been a large part of my wardrobe over the years, although I'm not currently wearing anything right now that came from here. But a lot of what I wear around here has come from previous years. It's fun to shop here. Haven't ever been a big fan of buying. It was not difficult to not buy very much. Experience has always been more important to me than stuff. So, you know, my life had a lot of theater and opera and dancing in it. Simple living is not boring. When I wrote this book, I was at the tail end of many years of working at home and freelancing, or working part-time at the ELCA Church Life as opposed to full-time, which later became my experience. But while I was based more at home, I had a lot more time for community activities, church, block club, PTA. So that was a large part of my life at that point. Whole Foods was far away from where I lived, so I tended to go to the neighborhood fruit stand where stuff basically came from Mexico. But during the summer, I was part of a community-supported agriculture farm, a very large one that's outside Chicago. It's one of the biggest in the United States. And I was the drop-off site for that for many years. So the bottom line here would be that I have the middle-class version of the simple life. I own property, I had a job at an IRA, I had insurance. I had a colleague who worked for Lutheran Woman Today magazine, who's from the South, and after she read the book, she drawled, "I get it, Anne. You're just a hippie with expensive tastes." That was her take on my version of simple living. But the thing about it is, you know, the book tells you that my process kind of started back in the 90s and what happened that sort of got me more and more simple. But all the way through, I was kind of living the same life, same house, same address, same child, same skill, applied freelancer in an office. But now, what we're talking about today, leaving the pack, I thought, let me have a session on this because I need advice. You know, it's kind of what I'm doing right now. So in the week before I came to Holman, I said goodbye to my job. I said goodbye to my congregation. I said goodbye to my old dog who has to stay with my sister-in-law. He's too old to travel. My son, who loaded up a van and drove to New Orleans to begin life as a graduate student at Tulane University. And I sold my house. So thank goodness I could come to Holman and kind of relax. That was sort of cataclysmic. When I began planning that change, I didn't think that was all going to happen in 1 week. But that's what happens to you when, you know, you put the for sale sign out. You just don't know when it's gonna happen. So I sort of, I've kind of dismantled this life that I used to go around to churches talking about. I can recommend it highly, but temporarily speaking, temporarily I'm kind of out of that life and not really sure where I am. And so I'm doing this because I am originally from the West Coast, I've been 26 years in Chicago. It's trying to make the transition back, and this is sort of the beginning of it. So I'm kind of in a transition, but and it was a good point in my life to start working on that. But it's been a lot of change. So I've had some time here to kind of reflect on what that means. It's funny that like an hour after I closed on the building. Oh, I should just let you know, I'm not talking this whole session. I talk a while, I have guest session, guest speakers, and then we talk. So the format of my things is a little talking and a lot of discussion, but I'm just filling in for you here. An hour after I sold the house and went across to stay at my neighbor's and had four bags or five bags that I couldn't deal with before I had to get everything out, I sat on the floor and I was sorting them and I thought, this is what it's like to be homeless. You sit, it's like the lady who sits by the bus and takes everything out of her shopping cart and arranges it. It was just weird. And then I went to stay with my sister-in-law, leaving the bags at one house and taking more with me. And I thought, this is another dimension of being homeless. You sort of leave your stuff around and say, I promise I'll come back for it. And then you forget about it. It was very eerie, so it was nice to come here. But it was interesting to take a look or to consider that in that week I kind of had let go of everything that defined me, you know, my address, my employment, my occupation as a mother, my pet. I came across as I was packing one of my freelance business cards, and I looked at it and I thought, you know, only the name is the same on this. Every single other thing here has changed. I can't even use it unless I cross everything off. So it was, and I didn't do this lightly. I come from a pretty stable family, you know, a grandfather who, like, was a small town doctor all the time, built two houses. Then I grew up in one house. My dad had the same job for 50 years, and I owned that building in Chicago for 26 years. I don't come from like a military family that moved around. So this has been big, very big. And I hear a lot of time during this process, people say, oh, you're so brave, man, you're so brave. And I have noticed the few times when I've been told by people, you're so brave, I think, ah, yeah, I've crossed a line, you know? I'm not sure what I just did, but there's a line. When people start telling you you're so brave, you've done something that they weren't expecting or that they would never consider doing themselves. So it's been kind of a high quotient lately of you're so brave comments.
Whether you're so brave or you're crazy.
Well,
that's
yeah.
What I was just going to say.
There is, well, Barbara speaking, you tell us about who told you you were crazy.
Yeah.
When you do this. Then I was reflecting about Gandhi. You know, I'm not Gandhi. You read about Gandhi's story and how he, you know, went to university, and then over the course of his life, his ministry became clear. He shed more and more good, so I think at the end he owned a spoon, you know. Mm-hmm. That isn't my goal. When I packed it, I got rid of lots of stuff, and I packed it in storage, and I'll move it out here, and I hope to unpack it someday and have less of it, but a spoon is going too far. So what I wanted, Holden is all about a place for us to have conversations and make space for alternatives, and through this week in all five of these sessions we'll be looking at a lot of, asking some questions about how we live and looking at alternatives. While we were here, I thought today, because Holden is about to undergo a whole lot of transition, a lot of people are leaving and more come in, there are a lot of experts on transition right now, and there's also a lot of people who like a little advice on big transitions and leaving the path. So I invited some people, not all of whom are here, to talk. And since that was sort of my story, I want us to hear a few others. And then maybe we can inquire together what it means, you know, for people to be sort of veering off the sanctioned path, sort of as our introduction to the topic for the week. So the people that I want to have speak are Barbara Bunk, who's in red. You can just raise your hand.
Hi.
There she is. The mother of Angela Gustafson, who's and the grandmother of Aubrey, proud grandmother of Aubrey, who's in the village visiting them. And I know Barbara from Global Mission because she and her husband and Angie and her sister were missionaries in, it's either CA or Cameroon or Cameroon, in Cameroon. And Dan from Portland. Dan Miller. No, I didn't know. Dan Miller from Portland will be talking to us, and John is here. Don and Jack Coffey, who've been here on long-term staff and are about to go out with good courage, not sure where. And then I'm looking for, did anybody come from Lutheran Volunteer Corps? Or did they all go next door? Okay, I think they went next door. They're you'll see around the village, there's a half dozen young people who just finished their year as Lutheran volunteers in different urban settings. And that's a program that is about social justice and intentional and quite low budget living. They spoke last week at one of our sessions, and it was really interesting to hear the economics, what kind of a stipend they give, and how they live together in community, and how they decide what food to buy and how to spend their time and money. So, actually, I would like to have Barbara come first. We'll set the chairs up.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
Can you briefly define the path?
The path? No. What is the path? Anybody want?
I mean, do you mean like house and kids and minivan and job and those sort of traditional type things?
I think that everybody would have a different definition of what their path would be. Yeah, so I didn't have, well, I was trying to think of a clever way to say this. So is path clear enough, or does anybody, I mean, it was just sort of deciding to kind of, maybe leaving your own path for a big change is maybe more what I meant. The path you had been on and making a big shift. So Barbara, I know I've relied on you in other sessions, because I think missionaries have such.
You didn't do well on that last.
Well, she shows up when I interview her. Missionaries are always wonderful people to talk about simple living, because they've had the experience of leaving our culture, adapting to another one with different values, and then coming back into this one. So maybe you could take a couple minutes to say, first of all, like when you become a missionary, you have to put your stuff in storage and give away your pets, right? And go somewhere.
I'm going to talk about that stage
that
of my
first,
life.
And then come back.
Okay.
For 4 minutes or so.
About 1993 at a global mission event, heard somebody talking about openings in Cameroon, and you have to know that I was a big failure several years before that as a missionary. You didn't know this?
No.
My husband, when I met him before we were married, was planning to be in Senegal, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. But I liked him, so loved him, got married, went there, didn't do well with culture shock and changes, and we went there right after we got married. I didn't know French that well, that kind of thing. Okay, so came back to the States, had our girls, and when they were about 9 and 11, we like going to global mission events. We heard somebody talking about Cameroon. And it was like a voice in my head said, you guys could do that. It was a real, message I got like that. And from then on, the whole process seemed like every step of the way, we should do this. This would be great. Everything about it sounded good. Our kids seemed like the kind of kids who would do well there. Everything we found out about the kids who were there, who told us about their school and everything. It's just everything seemed right except for the relatives who said, you're crazy, don't do it, that kind of thing. And even people in line at the stores when I was buying enough shoes for kids to grow into for 3 years. Oh, you could get shoes over there, but they go, what are you doing? Do you have like a daycare center? Do you have 12 children or what? But that's one thing we did. We had an auction and sold almost everything we had except the things that the relatives said, you can't sell that, that was grandma's, this kind of thing. And we go, yeah, maybe that would be nice to keep that. But we were at a stage of our life where the furniture was worn out anyway, and the kids seemed ready to go. And we had an auction, sold a lot, stored things at our parents' homes. And what was really nice when we came back, we were there 8 years, when we came back in 2002, both sets of parents were ready to move to like condominium type places, downsize, get what they had stored for us in their homes back into our hands. And so we came back and we really didn't still have a whole lot of stuff. So when you're talking stuff, that's one part of it. Mm-hmm. That's just a small part
small
of it,
part.
I think. It's the attitude of what you do with your stuff or why you're doing what you're doing. I'm jumping back to the present now. The last time I saw Anne, we were getting into a lot of stuff, and since I've seen you a year ago, we have a lot more stuff. Big stuff.
You do?
You want to hear what it is?
We're into stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, all right, what kind of
struggle
stuff
with
have?
This because I'm a tightwad and I've always been pretty simple in stuff. But
so what'd you
okay,
got?
We've always lived in a parsonage because we're rostered people, and we still live in a parsonage and love our work in rural South Dakota with four parishes. But suddenly we bought a lake home that's really kind of nice and modern, not huge. We got a little boat we call the Barbie doll boat. It's old, little. And then my husband bought me a baby grand for my birthday.
Wow, had a big year.
But I have this urge to get a lot of stuff out of there. But it's kind of big stuff that we really enjoy. And one of my friends told me she struggled with this a few years ago in adding on a big addition to their house. She got like a voice or a message that said, it's going to be used for the glory of God. And so somehow she's such a hospitable person that that place of theirs has been used so much.
Huh.
It's not that fancy of a house, so much for their kids and their friends, people coming in and staying. And that's how this lake home has come about. It felt okay to do it. And I struggle with that too. I go, what will everybody think in our churches? They all have lake homes. Not all of them, most of them. They're happy for us. We've had a lot of retreats there already in the last year. And the baby grand is just, that's just part of who I am. I just am enjoying that. So.
And pretty soon the baby comes to visit. This baby.
Yeah.
So you have to get a
crib. She's never
too.
Been there. Yeah.
You have to get some baby
but,
equipment.
You know,
she
we're
comes.
Kind of downsizing in some of our stuff, and this home will be our retirement home that, you know, we've never owned anything. So I struggle with some of that, and yet it seems to be that it's been used for some really wonderful things.
Great.
Lately.
Stay here.
Okay.
Let's have Dan come up, and Don, would you mind sitting up here too?
This is the session where I'm calling on all of you.
Dan approached me this morning before coffee to say, could I speak in your session? And he started to tell me about some of the changes he's made in his life, which were also really interesting sounding to me. We're just getting a potpourri of life experiences here, and then we'll hear from you. So,
shall I go?
Dan.
Okay.
Dan Miller.
Well, in the late 90s, early 2000s, like a lot of people, I worked a very conventional corporate life and, you know, lived in a two-bedroom apartment that I didn't need all the space and all that kind of stuff. And then I ended up moving to Portland. And by and by, in Portland, I came to live in a really neat co-housing community there that was a really cool place. And I owned a one-bedroom unit in that.
Does everybody know what co-housing is?
Mm-hmm. Well, the concept is that it's sort of an intentional community where there's shared space and a certain number of shared meals people determine and some kind of shared vision and ownership. Some places it might be co-op ownership, some places it might be condominium. An Oregon is typically condominium ownership because there's no legal structure for co-op ownership in Oregon. And so it was individually owned units. So it's, you know, there's more, I guess, private space than living in a group house or something like that. And it's, you know, it's like a cross between conventional living and communal living. Man, it was really neat. And the people, it came about very naturally and organically amongst really neat people I know who are all very activistic in various different things in Portland, various different communities there. And then, as wonderful as that is, and I'm still part of that community, but I got very fascinated with the idea of natural building. And in Oregon, there's a lot of natural building, not green building per se, but natural building, meaning using local natural materials, literally the local soil or wood or whatever, and specifically cob building, which is like adobe. Cob specifically comes from England and Wales and was reintroduced to the U.S. by a fellow who lives in Oregon now. And so that was in around 2005, and I just got really, I got fascinated with the idea of building as a natural human endeavor. Like all traditional cultures have their indigenous building techniques. Like professional home building is something that never existed before the 20th century, except for the royalty, let's say. And the process of building is, of natural building and traditional building, is also inherently communitarian because it tends to be fairly labor intensive, depending on, you know, you think of Amish barn raisings. And And cob building in particular is labor intensive. In short, you mix clay soil, usually from the site, sand, depending on whether how much sand is in the soil, and straw with water, and you just build the wall. And the straw acts as a sort of a rebar. And it's like adobe, except it's one continuous mass, so it's more stable. It's more seismically stable. And so I got really fascinated with that technique. And also, I reread Walden by Thoreau. And I read it my freshman year in college. It didn't register a lot. I reread it, and it really affected me, like the idea of, you know, the simplicity that he speaks of, and he's like such a forerunner of this whole movement. And so I didn't want to be too theoretical about it, but the idea of sort of taking that concept and updating it to the context of urban and, frankly, more communal than Thoreau was. You know, he built this little cabin entirely by himself, and, you know, he was part of a community, but he was like the guy out on the pond, too.
Whose sister did his wash, remember?
Right.
You have to think about that. He was about 150 yards away from civilization, yeah. And his sister took care of a lot of those needs. So, he was still a great thinker about American simplicity.
Oh, yeah, no, he was like an American philosopher.
I think, basically, she did. I think that he had a lot of community support.
Yeah, true.
Sorry.
But the building of Cobb, it's inherently, I guess you would say, democratic. Like, it's not high-skill building. There is a learning curve. It does involve a certain amount of carpentry and whatnot. But anybody can work on a Cobb building site. You know, generally, you stomp the mud on a tarp or mud pit. And so just because I'm lucky to know a lot of people in Portland, I did enlist the help of lots of friends to help me with that. And so anyway, I have a friend who had downsized, sold a larger house, bought a smaller house in North Portland, and she kind of wanted something like a mother-in-law in the backyard. She thought maybe she'd buy a yurt, something. And it just sort of came together, and I said, you know, I'm really fascinated by the idea of building a Cobb mini house. And just experimenting with this whole idea of being as minimal as you can be in the city and engaging natural building and traditional building technique and community and all that stuff, and like what you can do with that. And so in the summer of 2006, I spent building that thing, and it was huge. Even though the place is only about 190 square feet, approximately 10 by 20, but it has a curved wall. It was a big project. I would like to, you know, it was all an experiment, and I'd like to do it again in some other more larger communal context in terms of, like, the site, let's say. Because it's in an urban neighborhood, and it's behind a house, and there's a skinny house on either side, you know, the kind, with the snout garage and all that.
So you live behind the house?
Yes, I live behind the house.
In the Cobb house?
Yeah, and the soil, like, the earth and the clay soil was all from the site. I dug, like, we had to dig drainage trenches. We got it all from there. And we got as much of the lumber as we could from the rebuilding center, which is a, you know, they deconstruct old houses and have and the windows and the sink and all kinds of stuff like that. So we tried to be as, like, there's this idea of embodied energy in manufacturing and building, and like trying to make it just as little embodied energy as possible, so that this thing is just looks like it grew on the site.
But when you're inside, I mean, I've read about this. Like, mm-hmm. There's like a wood floor, or you sweep the
it's
dirt.
A, it's
just
earthen,
tell us what it's like inside, too.
So these cob walls, and on the inside, I plastered them with kaolin white plaster, like basically kaolin clay from a ceramic supply store, mixed with sand and finely chopped straw and some other things. And so basically a whitewashed interior, kind of rough, you know, I was definitely a beginner, it's a beginner project. But, and an earthen floor, basically a cob floor, but not, I wouldn't say a fine earthen floor. There are people who do that who just do incredibly fine clay earthen floors. You know, it's something you pay a premium for. And then the exterior, I just did a rough earthen plaster on the exterior. Ideally it would be a beautiful lime plaster exterior.
But it doesn't leak when it rains in Portland?
No, it has a roof with eaves and reused galvanized roofing shingles that are cost more than asphalt ones, but they last longer.
And how many square feet is your house?
It's about a couple hundred. The spot it was on was approximately 10 by 20.
So from your co-housing condo to this, what kind of a reduction in space
was Probably, that one bedroom place was probably about 600 square feet.
And now you're in 200.
Like, so yeah, and part of it was like simplifying my goods.
Yeah.
And that was all a deliberate thing, you know. And my ideal would be like everything I need is in there. In a building like that, inherently there's not a lot of storage space. And the truth is I have a bunch of stuff in the basement, in the house there, and in our bike shed, and I just want to like heat that stuff in a pile and toss gasoline on it. But I can't.
But you haven't yet.
I haven't yet. When I get back.
No.
Do you have a kitchen in there?
Yeah, there's one corner of it, like, it's so, the size of it, you know, people go in there like, wow, this is perfect, because like, in one corner is sort of shaped like this, and like, so there's a little stovey unit, like a convection oveny thing, just big enough to cook, and a two burner thing, and a fridge, and a sink, and we put pipe and electric conduit in the house, and we did that on the DL, under the table, and you know, the city.
I was gonna ask
that. Yeah, I mean, you can have unpermitted structures of under 200 square foot in the city, but electric and plumbing, it's supposed to be, you know, have like a $10,000 permit.
Okay.
And all this.
We promise.
Anyway,
we don't know your address.
I once was having this discussion at a barbecue, and the woman I was talking to turned out to work for the Department of Building Services, and she was like, "Oh, no, don't worry, I'm."
So we kind of heard Barb's story of stuff and moving in an international location, and then you moved in the same town to a different kind of house, and then I think along the way you changed your job a little bit too.
Through doing that and through the first segment of my living there, it was kind of a labor trade because I was enamored with this idea of being not as much within the conventional money economy. I'm still definitely within it, but like labor trade with my friend who owns the place, but who's actually now just sold it. I'm going to be a conventional renter there, and which was a weird feeling because there's a certain proprietariness of having initiated this project. But
yeah.
Anyway, but it was always meant as an experiment. I'm going to live there forever anyway. So.
Okay. And then Don and Jack Coffey are long-term people who are about, well, I'm just Don, just mentioning. There's a Jack too. There's a few other coffees. Kind of representing, I don't know, the path as question. I leave it to you to tell us what you'd like to share.
Well, long ago I'd been at Holden when I was a 20-year-old, and so I know Holden, and then life went on, and I'm a pastor, an ELCA pastor, and so is my husband, and we became pastors in midlife, and then we were assigned to a four-point parish in western Nebraska. That was our first call, and we were there 7 years, and it was pretty demanding, kind of a high learning curve for a new pastor, and kind of remote, and a little bit hard on the kids to be where we were. And so at the end of 7 years, we were just kind of tired and weren't ready. We needed to go to a new call. We knew that. We needed to be done where we were, but we were just not ready to take on the rigors of a new call. So we asked to come to Holden on staff. And we were granted that, and we were given a year to be here. And when we were halfway through that, we decided to extend and be here 2 years. And so now we're coming to the end of that time, and we thought that, well, we just would get a call then when we're done here. Well, there was a big economic downturn in this past 2 years, and right now it isn't that easy to have a call as a pastor, because a lot of pastors have come back out of retirement, and a lot of them are just staying where they are. They're not moving. So there's not a lot of openings. So we're leaving here in a week, and we don't have a call. We have children, we have family, when we first figured out that a call wasn't going to be in place when we left here, it was really scary. It was really hard, and it's really, we were down on ourselves and all that. And then we somehow worked through some of that, and along the way, someone who's here at Holden has a house over on the coast of Washington and said, well, we're not using that, we're working here, you can use it. So we were given a house to go to. We've never been there, and we'll go there in a week. And we enrolled the kids in the school there. And so we're going somewhere we've never been, and we don't know how long we'll be there. We'll continue to see if we can have a call somewhere.
So what synod do you work through? You must belong to a synod somewhere.
Yes, and this is the problem, because I talk about this and everyone thinks, okay, we've got to fix you.
Yeah.
Fix the situation.
Get you
in the call. But I don't think you have to do that. We Nebraska Synod is where we were, and that's where our paperwork is out of. But we've got our names in a lot of places, and we don't really understand why it's not coming through. But there's probably a reason, and maybe in a year or two I can tell you why. But right now, I can't. And so.
And I sold it all after my son moved, and well, you took your kids with you to Cameroon, and you're sort of taking your kids with you over to Ocean Shores. How are the? I mean, sometimes you know you can be. I think, does Dan, you're single, right? There's no toddler in your 200 square foot.
That's right.
Okay. Sometimes you're making these decisions for yourself. Sometimes you're making them in a family context. So, with the kids in this move, how are the kids?
You should probably ask me in a month.
Okay.
When we've done this. At this point, they're, mildly curious. They know we have to leave here. Nobody stays at Holden forever.
Yeah.
And most people don't stay as long as we've stayed. Mm-hmm. And that's just a given. And they know that. And so. Mm-hmm.
How old are they?
One has just one semester of high school left.
Oh.
And one is 13 and one is 6. So the whole gamut.
That's only half the group, but that's
we have
that's the
ones
that's with you.
Yeah, they're the ones that are with us.
Yeah.
So it could be terrible. I don't know. We'll see. It's an adventure, and I don't want to say it'll be terrible. It'll be fine. It'll be both. Everything.
Sorry.
I was gonna say not to be stereotypical about it, but it is one of those things where you sort of have to have faith, trust, comfortable with the uncertainty, and know that literally God provides and all that.
Well, there's a little difference. It's that both of you kind of chose what you're doing. This wasn't the path we were.
Yeah.
Thought
yeah.
that we'd go down, it's just the way it's worked out, and it's probably the way it's worked out for a lot of people whose jobs have been eliminated or the company's downsized, and they all of a sudden, they're in a whole new situation.
Yeah.
And I think that's more what we're in.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that distinction. It's kind of like a person who chooses the path and the other one who the path chooses
them.
I appreciate that distinction.
Uh-huh. I think too, that what you're describing is more the simple living for the majority of people in the world, because the majority of people in the world live much more simply than what we would consider simple living.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily choose it. That's the only option. Right?
Mm-hmm. Any other path stories anybody wants to share? Or I see our LBC person has walked in too, but yes, ma'am.
Well, this is not personal, but there's a book called Living High. I don't know if anyone's read it, but it's about a couple from the East Coast that come. comes and buys an island in the San Juan Islands, and it's a tiny island called Walburn Island. And this
they
is
bought Walburn Island, okay.
And they give them everything. And I mean, there's nothing on the island. They have to build their house, and they go everywhere by boat. I think the husband gets a job doing something in lumber. But anyway, it's a fascinating story about how you can just start with absolutely nothing and survive. But the really interesting thing was about a month ago, I was at a seminar, and this woman got up and talked about growing up on this island and being a child in the woods and going to this tiny little school. And anyway, and then she mentioned this island, I went up and talked to her, and it turned out she was the granddaughter of these people. So I went up to her and I said, well, what's going on now? And she said, the fifth generation now is still on the island. So I thought, you know, you never know what this path will take you to. So it's interesting to me.
Gertrude.
I would like to refer to what came up here a little bit, that you have chosen some of this, and sometimes life happens and you're in the same situation. For instance, after 22 years of marriage, my husband decided he was unhappy and he wanted a divorce. And so all of a sudden, from a big house with 5 acres and more of acreage, I lived in this little apartment. The kids were, one was going to college, the other one eventually did move in with it. He had a year and a half of school left, high school. And I had nothing. He had cleaned out all the bank accounts. It took me 9 weeks to find a job because I had not worked in 19 years. He did not want me to work. And yes, I had been a secretary before, but computers had happened. And I never sat at a computer. But it is amazing, you know, what the survival, what happens. I did get a job at a local hospital after 3 years. I decided I needed to do something, and I went back to school. Well, I'd never been to college. I grew up in Germany. I'd never been to college. I went to college. I graduated with honors. I had a job, and things went well. I got remarried. I can afford a cleaning lady 3 hours twice a month. I mean, that's a huge room where I've been, but you never forget. Something that's and I had to do it in the simple living, and to this day there are things where I'm saying we're getting too much stuff. I mean, what is all this stuff? We don't need all this. And so you can of course, again, one person can live pretty simply. It's different when you have a family.
When there's a family, it's a different question.
But what I found so much was comparing myself to other people, I knew something. I could take classes, I could take courses. I mean, anything that that hospital was offered, I took it. I was never going to be unemployable again. So, you know, you have an education, you have somewhere that come all together.
This is like coming from the mission field, though. Many of our friends, we have mutual friends, are going through the same thing. We wait longer than we used to have to.
It is hard right now for missionaries coming back, because then there's a little bit of transitional support that comes from Global Mission, and then after that, it's tough. And there's some cultural reentry issues sometimes that you're also dealing with. There was a hand back there.
Yeah, just we did something, again, that the family members thought we were crazy. In 1994, with our 2-year-old son and our 1-year-old, or 6-month-old daughter, we bought a house with another couple who was pregnant at the time. And they ended up having 2 kids. And so the 8 of us, we were just friends, no relations or anything. The 8 of us lived together for 8 years. And there were some things that were much easier in that situation. You know, I mean, buying groceries and household items, everything was half off. Because we had a joint bank account, which we each paid into equally. So it was like 50% off of everything we got. And childcare was much easier. You know, anytime we could, you know, we could go on a date. Okay, go watch the kids. You know, it was just instant childcare. And so you had a lot more energy left over to be creative and patient and all with their kids, because you were sharing that with the other family. But there were, you know, of personality things and questioned decisions about the house that became more complicated. So it wasn't, there were definitely some things that, that made simpler and wonderful in many ways, and definitely some more complicated things. It's kind of a double-edged sword.
So you're not doing that anymore?
No, we split up in 2002. It's going to be, this March will be almost 8 years since we ended our 8-year. They live close by. Our kids are still best friends. We do stuff together, you know, so we're still amicable. Although there was definitely some tension at the time of splitting. But we're still very good friends.
Wow, that's a really interesting story.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to speak to that, the co-housing thing a little bit, because it's similar to that in the sense, like the co-housing where I lived and other ones that I know of, there's a lot of families. Like when I was there, it was, you know, some young couples who've since had kids, and like, you know, maybe similar to families who are at Holden, there's like, it's just that literal sort of having a village to look after kids, and they're always running around, and it's much more traditional in a sense, not like a completely isolated nuclear family, and it's really makes it easier and simpler for those families who live there in that sense. Mm-hmm. And there's a few more, so maybe it's not as much potential tension. There's, you know, there's just a couple. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I wanted to mention one thing. I don't want to talk too much, but there's a book called Traveling Light that came to mind when you were talking about Gandhi's last possession. Mm-hmm. It's a book. All it is lists of various people's final possessions.
Wow. Now that's interesting.
It's really cool.
Huh.
Yeah. Like what they had. Various people, like Thomas Merton when he was killed.
Oh, like what was with them, or like what was in their house with them? What, how did they define possession?
I believe it was like what they owned. I'm pretty sure it was what they owned.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dan, have you seen there's a book of photographs photographer went around the world.
Yeah, Material World. It's in the bookstore in the library.
Oh, yeah. The possessions on the front lawn.
Right. Out to the front.
I've seen that.
What's that called?
Material World.
Is that in Material World?
Material World.
It's incredible.
It is amazing.
What's the name?
At Material World, it's a photographic essay, and what's really nice about it is that it's not meant to be judgmental. It mostly looks at how we, my colleague Sunitha would say, if you're missing her session, go tomorrow, please, how we do life, how different cultures do life. So, you know, in Asian cultures where, you know, they're not just putting their stuff out, they're also kind of making a hierarchy of what's the most important things to them. So, you know, which ones have, you know, the Americans holding the Bible, the people from Bhutan with the household gods in front. You know, you can just, you get a sense of what people value. And it's very non-judgmental. It's just the stories just draw you in, and it's a fascinating way of comparing a lot of things. It's,
I like the YouTube version too, because it just kind of pops up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a YouTube version?
Yeah.
Okay.
Photographs with all the.
And this is when I were a Lutheran Volunteer Corps graduate. And I forget, you are not Jacob.
I'm Brandon.
You're Brandon.
I was just at the other session, and I'm actually drawing a connect right now between something that they were talking over there, which is this difference between the individualistic way that a lot of people do life in this country and the communal way that, you know, many other cultures around the world do life. And then this conversation here about simplicity through community. And in my own vision, and part of what I gained out of my short year doing Lutheran Volunteer Corps, was the value of community into a simple life, a simpler life at least. And someone after your last session, Anne, asked me or said, you know, I really hope that you stay on kind of that path of simplicity. We're doing a lot of things in our house to kind of limit our consumerism and be more friendly to the earth, and a lot of just things where we encourage each other. And I said, you know, I think on my own I couldn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. But with other people, if I continue to stay in that community, I can really do it. I'm really inspired to hear your story, because what's been on my mind a lot in this transition from this really supportive Lutheran Volunteer Corps year to setting my feet down in Seattle is, what I've been thinking about in my life right now is I just got engaged to my partner, and we collectively decided to counter that, the model of like just like getting a place, instead we're starting a community house, so that we can, it's on a lot of levels, like grab those communal values into, I mean, I'm 23, like if I think if I was 35 and then I was like, hey, let's do a community, let's take my marriage into a community, I think that would be really challenging. But we're at this age and we have this like vision for knowing that there's a connect between like starting out in that community to building these other values up, that we've gained a lot in this last Lutheran Volunteer Corps year, and then it, you know, bringing those into our marriage and life.
We were 35 when we did it.
And I'm so impressed. I'm glad there was a transition.
Kind of. I mean, it was kind of like a marriage squared or cubed or something, which was both good and bad. You know, you had, the three of them would come home from work and I'd have dinner already, you know, and then somebody else would do the dishes. I mean, you know, you had four people doing all the domestic stuff, sharing that. But then you had four times the personality differences and, you know, tensions to talk through. We had lots of household meetings, and we even went to counseling.
Really?
All four of us, you know, over some years. And it turned out that my husband and the other husband, you know, we all did the Myers-Briggs test, and they were exact opposite personalities, and not only exact opposite, but extreme. So you could see where some of the difficulties were going to be. But,
wow.
You know, it worked for 8 years, and then it
was very well. I saw Carrie had her hand up.
Yeah, mine kind of ties in with both those comments, because my husband, Steve, we just got here yesterday to work here for a while, but we met in the 80s here, so in our 20s, and community's kind of hard. We were tired of meetings, I went to Sojourners, which is another community. So we decided we wanted to do our simple lifestyle by ourselves. So he's from Texas, we went to Texas and farmed, and two different farms over 19 years, and you know, the whole deal with vegetables and the outhouse and cloth diapers, you know, the whole bit. And it wasn't very simple lifestyle either, because when we moved from one farm to the other, you have your candle making bowls, and you have your canning things, and your jars, and your honeybees, and you know, it was 30 truckloads.
Wow.
Oh my God.
So, you know, the simple lifestyle, at least the kind of rural simple lifestyle, is sort of laughable.
Takes equipment.
Takes hot stuff. And Steve's very gifted, you know, he can weld, he can plumb, he can do electrician. So we were able to do a lot of stuff by ourselves. But it's kind of lonely. I mean, at this point, and the reason we're here now, I have to say, is because, you know, you look around in the winter when you're not growing stuff, and we don't really have neighbors. My family's in Oregon. His was 100 miles away from our farm. The Texas communities close to us are, you know, really pro-Bush and very Republican and very suspicious of organic gardeners. So we tried to do it without the community context, like you're saying. And it worked okay for a while, but I think for a long term, you know, some sort of family or community support. So, for what that's worth, we tried it for a while, and we'll probably go back. But I think if I spend the school year in town and commute to the farm or something to include more people.
And I think that there's something to be said about shifting the whole culture a little bit, like towards. You mentioned co-community, you know, being able to still have a little bit of a traditional model for partnerships and whatnot, you know, smaller homes, but in a community where maybe there's some shared meals and shared ideas sharing about, what are we all doing to be better stewards of our resources, to be a little bit communal in our outlook. I think that there's some medium ground that could easily be shifted towards as a whole.
Mm-hmm. It does take a lot of time to maintain your own house and life. Part of the delight of coming to Holden, I always say, is like, you know, walk 30 seconds, have a cup of coffee, sit down and meal. Later, you put your part of the work into it, But what you're, but you're not having to create every single aspect of your life all day long the way most of us. I mean, if you think about it, you know, sewer systems, school systems, mail delivery systems, electricity. We're surrounded by systems, which we'll talk about tomorrow. So a lot of things are provided communally for us, which we pay through taxes and other means. But within that, we still have a lot of labor when we have all these single family households. And then there's the privilege of being able to shut the door at night when you want to. It's kind of a trade-off. Stefan?
And I want to come back to your book again. The part of, I think the title is Sustainable Simplicity.
Sustaining Simplicity.
Sustaining Simplicity. And for me, that's an underlying key concept of that it's really, for me, more about sustainability. Mm-hmm. If I'm consuming more than I can sustain, or the culture, or the society, so that there's inherent for me in a proof, kind of a test for how I look at simplicity, is it sustainable? Where's this stuff coming from? Mm-hmm. How does it come into the system, be it an individual or family system or social system? How does it get consumed and go run mm-hmm. through the system? So really sustaining, sustainable, that's simple can be so relative for me. So I'm mm-hmm. just kind of curious, you know, of how sustaining, sustainability fits into the, as a mm-hmm. measuring parameter of mm-hmm. the simplicity. Mm-hmm. So I liked your title on, for me, that was really a key operative word mm-hmm. for me.
Maybe we'll get more into sustainability tomorrow, and, or Wednesday and Thursday.
But I think,
it looks like a hand going up.
I think one thing that's coming out is for it to be sustaining, that all of our human needs need to be met.
Yeah.
Community, mm-hmm. Just all the psychological needs as well. Mm-hmm. Not that we have to focus just on our needs, but we can sustain something longer if we're not denying ourselves something
yeah.
vital.
Yeah.
I mean, life should be a joy.
Right.
Whether you're in a cob house or a farmhouse or a beach house or a mountain village
as
or an apartment.
As society changes, I think,
yeah.
Toward simplicity and more earth-friendly practices, I think that allows it to be more sustainable. I'm thinking about Portland, and two of our daughters live there and do not feel they need to own cars because the public transportation is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were their age, we, I think it was about 9 years, we decided to ride bicycles everywhere or take public transportation. But there wasn't a lot of support for that. We got, mm-hmm. you know, it was hard
yeah.
to do it.
Yeah.
And ultimately when I sort of broke that pact that we had together was to go climbing with some college co-students, and we needed to get there by car, and it was a big deal to have committed to something and then decide, well, this is more complicated mm-hmm. than just being pure on one level. Mm-hmm. So I did, and that was a good choice.
Yeah, I think as we talk this week about simple living, I hope, you know, there isn't one prescription. Sometimes I think of our lives that we're trying to do here. I'll just make a generalization for all of us. It's not that it's simple. It's more that it's intentional. You thought about it. You know what your values are. You know how you're trying to embody those values in the way you're living. But you also know that, you know, you need a chocolate chip cookie with milk twice a day or something. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's not like,
right.
I will live this way. I will observe this number of calories. I will only, I mean, people can really get into that, but that's not what I'm talking about. I think, to me, the term simple living encompasses a lot of different ways of living that free things up in us,
mm-hmm.
as well as benefit communities and the earth, I hope. So I certainly don't mean anything doctrinaire or, you know, that we have to do a certain thing. I hope this will be a shared inquiry this week about some of the alternatives that are available to us and how they benefit us.
Maybe the Shakers have a lesson for us too. They shook it down to where life is simple, but they're not around anymore.
Yeah, right. And why was that? Everybody remember
why?
They didn't. They wouldn't have sex. So yeah. So the Shaker cult. That was part of becoming a Shaker.
Yeah, simplicity without sustainability.
Yeah.
getting to know each other a little more. We can talk about this over supper, and then Wednesday we'll look at, I think it's an afternoon class, and we'll look at some of these structural and system questions that underlie our culture and lead us to our choices. Thank you, everybody.